Accession number 27347, reel 24.
Stanley Brand, reel 24.
So, was there anything else that occurred after the convoy, after the gale in the convoy, as you were heading westwards?
Yes, that was when we had our bedding down with the Merchant Navy crew. The chief engineer was a tower of strength. He was always on deck when there was flying going on, and he delegated his Merchant Navy duties to his second engineer and third engineer and fourth engineer and even to the apprentice. But he was always on deck. He took charge of the barriers and the arrestor wires, and whenever we had a prang, his expertise was there to advise on disentangling and cutting wires and cutting wreckage and how to move it. And we had, I would say, up to 50 or 60 people on deck helping to lift and move wreckage, especially if there was another aircraft in the air to let him get down. Speed was terribly important. And a wrecked aircraft would disappear. All valuables would disappear out of it. Things like compasses and clocks and joysticks, anything of any value, would be ripped out and the rest pumped over the side. We did have a platform which was about 6 feet by 30 feet, with angle iron upstands around it and cleats all over the place for anchoring a rope. Anything that we wanted to salvage, we'd put on that platform. It was abaft the bridge, so that it wasn't going to form an extra obstruction, and it'd be tied down and tarpaulined over to save any equipment that we could. The rest of it went over the side without any valuables.
How would the aircraft be secured to the decks, the flying aircraft?
With the cleats in the deck and ropes from the wingtips, from the undercarriage. They'd be well chocked, of course, so it didn't roll about. Sideways movement was one of the difficult things with the plane on deck. You could stop the wheels going forward and backwards by chocks, but you couldn't stop it sliding sideways except by tying the wingtips down. But you couldn't tie those too tightly, otherwise you could stress the main spars in the wing. Corrosion was a difficult enough thing, but you didn't want stress cracks appearing. Yes, we used to tie them down pretty thoroughly. The only shelter that we had was barricades which were hinged around the perimeter of the aft third of the deck. Was covered with these hinged plates which could be erected and propped to break the wind. They were perforated sheets of steel. They had about 2-inch diameter holes all over them. They stood about 8 feet high, and they were about 4 feet wide with gaps of 3 feet between them. They were the only protection that the boys had to do the servicing. And under gale conditions, all they did was deflect some of the wind. Yes, the deck was a very exposed place. That night, after we'd tied some wreckage down on the graveyard, as we called it, I went up to inspect the lashings, and there was movement, sideways movement. So I climbed over the tarpaulin wreckage to the outboard side, and I'd just got to the outboard side when the ship rolled to that side and the wreck moved. It was still on what we called skates. It moved towards me and it trapped my flying boot between the skate and this angle iron upstand. That saved me from going over the side. The rope that I caught was one that had rubbed and frayed and snapped, but I caught hold of the end and it saved me going over the side. But I'll never forget looking down and seeing the white fluorescence of the breakers along the side of the ship and thinking they'd never find me. So I hung on like grim death. I climbed back, having secured the wreckage, and I was going across the deck when I realised that she was digging her bows in, and she dug them into a wall of a wave and scooped it up, and I suddenly realised I was going to be washed off the deck if I didn't do something. So I dropped down and I wrapped my arms around the arrestor wire, and it scooped up a wall of water about 4 feet deep, and it hit me, and I hung on like grim death, knowing full well that this wire was greased, and there I had my brand new Irving suit. It showed the grease for a long, long time afterwards, but it saved my life. Yes, it was an introduction, that first journey, an introduction that made me respect the Atlantic, a healthy respect, with a modicum of fear as well, realising just how puny we were and how forceful everything was and how big it was. Anyway, it also made me appreciate human beings. Being away from the convoy, you feel very alone. And the comradeship, when you got back to the ship, was marvellous. On one landing, that was after fog, it was a long time afterwards, but I remember feeling absolutely drained. I'd been flying through fog, and after coming to a standstill, I shut my eyes, and I think my head drooped a bit, and I remember the chief petty officer climbing up to undo my straps and help me get out, and he shouted down to the rest of the crew, "That's what he can do with his eyes shut." They're a grand crowd. Always a wise crack to lighten what could be a serious moment.
Are there any more incidents that occurred during that first?
Yes, several. I'm not sure whether it was the first. One merged into another after a while. I find it difficult because these weren't things that went into your logbook. The logbook was a very bare report on what you'd done. It gave the time, it gave what you did, but it didn't give any of the background. And if a flight was less than 5 minutes, you were not allowed to put it in. On one occasion, we were flying and noticed that the locking arm that had the that held the wings spread, the locking pin, locking arm was vibrating up, and it was at 45 degrees. It was almost disengaged. We'd gone off in the dark, and come the light, I saw this thing, and any minute the wing could have folded on us, which of course would have been a catastrophe, because it would have been one side, and it would have come back over the fuselage, and we couldn't have got out. We would have just gone down like a sycamore seed. And Bill, my observer, said, just keep it steady. And he started to unfasten his G-string, the thing that anchored him in the cockpit, and did his parachute to leave it behind so it didn't encumber him. And it was on the starboard side, which on the Swordfish hasn't got footholds for you to go down. If it had been the port side, there would have been footholds to get down there. But he always carried a sheath knife, we all did, in his flying boot. And he had that sheath knife on a lanyard, which he then put round his neck. And he came over the top of me, cut holes in the fabric to get down onto the stub wing, and he kicked the handle down into position and tied it down with a lace that he'd had holding his eraser, his rubber, on the chart board. And he tied it down, and then he came back in. That was the first instance of Bill doing something which I felt was worthy of recognition. And I asked the air staff officer to recommend him for some recognition. He said, all I can do is recommend to 836's CO when we get back, which he did. And the CO of 836 Squadron said, what was it but self-preservation? So I had to concede that. On a later occasion, we'd pranged all three aircraft in the first 6 or 7 days of the crossing, so we hadn't any more protection. And then the weather cleared up, and we couldn't do anything except sunbathe. And the convoy was without any aerial protection, because by that time we'd got out of the land plane range. So I walked around and had a look at these wrecks, which we were dismantling and trying to save bits. And I realised that we had an undamaged pair of port wings and an undamaged pair of starboard wings, a fuselage which hadn't taken any shocks, it hadn't had the undercarriage broken, an engine where the propeller had stopped naturally instead of being wrapped in the wire, so the engine hadn't had a shock. And I thought, if we could all bring all these together, we can make one good aeroplane. So I talked it over with the ground crew, and then I went to see the air staff officer and suggested how it could be done. He said, you can't do that. He said, it'd never be passed as airworthy. I said, well, I'd test fly it, of course. And then I realised what I'd said. So they took me up on this, and we dismantled and reassembled, and we made one good aeroplane out of three. Now, we hadn't any jigs for settling the angle of attack. You couldn't rig a plumb bob at sea. It all had to be done by guess and by God. So we did, and we got near the point where it looked like an aeroplane again. We put a strop around the mast and used that as a crane with block and tackle, and got the boys heaving on it to lift the plane up, lift the fuselage up so we could put undercarriage underneath it. Anyway, around about, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were getting near, and the air staff officer came to me and said, well, Stanley, you better go and get some sleep, hadn't you? Because we'd worked right through the night before. I said, I'm not going to go and have sleep while it's in this condition. He said, you need to have a sleep. You're all keyed up. And I realised then that he meant because you're going to fly it, you'd better go and have a sleep. And then the awful reality came, what I'd done. No aircraft would ever be assembled like that and then test flown. It would be taxied, well, it would be checked with jigs and all the rest of it. So I went and I had a sleep. I lay there thinking rather than sleeping. And the time came, getting near to dusk, and our last chance to do the flight that day. We wanted it for dawn patrol next morning. So I went out to take it off. And Bill, my observer, went and got all his flying kit, and I said, you're not coming with me. He said, yes, I am. I said, but there's no need. Why take the risk? He said, you never know. And he insisted on coming with me. Well, I opened up and I just got rolling level with the bridge, and I realized that she was nose heavy because the tail came up like this behind me, and I was afraid that my propeller was going to hit the deck. It was too late to do anything. I had full engine on, and I went over the bow. But I sank down over the bow, and my wheels hit the water of a crest of a wave. And she was so heavy at the nose that I had one foot on the instrument panel and the stick right back, and the tail trim wound as far back as I could get it. And I couldn't take any engine off because she would have dropped her nose down again. Afterwards, I was described as being like the most senior, swan in a gaggle of swans at the end of the breeding season, trying to take off. I could visualise that with them trying to paddle and get airborne, flapping lazily. Apparently I was hitting the crest of nearly every wave and leaving a paddle behind me, and feeling tired like the end of the breeding season. Anyway, I couldn't get any height at all, and over the intercom I said to Bill, for God's sake, make sure you're strapped, because I expected to go in the drink any minute with a thump, with full throttle on. And he said, hold it steady, I'm going aft. And I felt the load easing just a little. Instead of hitting the wave crests, I started to get some height. I got up to about 30 feet. so that I could look round, and there was Bill sitting astride the fuselage, and he'd cut holes in the fin, the tail fin, for a handhold, and he was sitting there hanging on like grim death. And as I looked round, he looked round at me. He had a beard, a black beard, and lovely white teeth, and he was grinning, and he gave me a thumbs up, left hold long enough to give me a thumbs up. So I had full throttle, full speed, and I got up to about 35 feet, something like that. So I made a pass at the deck. Fortunately, things had quietened down by then, and it was evening. There was a pretty good light, and the ship wasn't going up and down too much. But I made a full throttle approach without being able to sink onto the deck. And if the stern had come up, I would have hit it, and Bill would have been catapulted, because the thing that would have hit would be my undercarriage, and I would have done that, and him out on the tail, he would have gone over my head. What had happened was that the whole tail plane on the Swordfish is on a rack and pinion system, so that when you wind the tail trim back, it alters the angle by the rack and pinion going up on the leading edge of the tail plane. It alters the angle of the tail plane, and of course the more the leading edge goes down, the heavier it becomes in the tail. But we'd got it too high on the leading edge by, I think, 3 teeth on the rack and pinion, so that it was nose heavy. After landing, they corrected that, and it was on dawn patrol next morning.
Was Bill on the tailplane as you landed?
Yes. If I'd hit anything, it was certain death for him. So once again, I recommended that he got some commendation for it. And the CO once again said self-preservation. I said, but Sergeant Hanna in the RAF went out when there was an engine on fire in a Wellington, and he put it out with gloved hands, and he got the VC for that. Bill deserves something. And the CO's reaction was, if you prefer the actions of our sister service, I can get you a transfer there in a matter of days. All you have to do is say the word and you can go. Which made me feel sick. It turned out afterwards that when he was a midshipman out in Malta in the early days of the war, he'd done something similar, and he'd never got any recognition. So he was applying that standard throughout the squadron. And at no time did anybody in 836 Squadron get any recognition. Not even one of the Merchant Navy skippers, every one of whom deserved a medal. Everyone at least deserved the OBE. None of them got a thing.
One of the things that came up in the two stories you were saying there was about the locking device on the wings. I don't think we'd actually discussed how that works on an aircraft to have folding wings.
The two cones, there's a male cone on the stub wing and a female cone on the wing that folds, and it's hinged some distance away from the two, and when the wings are spread, the female cone comes over the male cone, and there's a square hole cut through the combined, and a square pin comes down through them, and that's worked on a hinged fulcrum, and the handle brings it down, and the pin goes through the two so they can't separate. The handle then has a clip with a spring in it that meets another clip and does that so that it can't move. The spring had broken in ours, so that there was nothing to hold the clip in, the handle in the down position, and with vibration it had parted and the handle went up to 45 degrees. If it had come to 90 degrees it would have been disengaged entirely.
And on that, well, we were talking initially about the first trip that you had to that. What happened when you got to the other side?
When we got to the other side, we flew off before we got into harbour and landed at the Royal Canadian Air Force airfield at Dartmouth, just on the outskirts of Halifax. This was a station rather like Maydown, where it kept swordfish in reserve, gave all the facilities for crews, gave us all the facilities for swinging our compasses. So we flew ashore there from about 50 miles out, and the convoy protection was then taken over by a land-based aircraft and Royal Canadian Navy frigates and corvettes, extras. Our first job when we got ashore, apart from going to the loo, was to swing our compasses. As you can appreciate, after being tied down on deck with vibration, magnetism is transferred to an unmagnetized piece of metal. If you vibrate it or hit it with a hammer, in the presence of a magnetic field. Well, we had varying magnetic fields because we were going fairly well north. The field, normal magnetic field, varies considerably from Britain to Halifax. We'd had all the vibrations of propeller coming out of the water in a rough sea. We'd had thumping landings on deck, and our compasses could be as much as 10 or 15 degrees out. Now, when your life depends entirely upon getting back to a square mile in the ocean, and the only tool you've got, the only tool you're allowed to use, I should say, is a magnetic compass, you want it to be as near perfect as you can get it. So we used to go and swing our compasses and correct them. That was the first job.